Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Clarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Today, my guest is Charles Atkins, MD. He's a board-certified psychiatrist, clinical trainer, and author of both fiction and nonfiction books. His latest book, Elixir, is a medical thriller about new discoveries, betrayal, murder, and greed. Good morning, Charles. How are you this morning?
I'm great. How you doing?
Good, good. Well, first of all, in this time of pandemic, how are you holding up?
You know, the particular boat I am in this storm is holding up well, and I am abundantly aware that, you know, other folks in other boats are not doing so well, and there are some people who are in the storm and don't have a boat at all.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, your new book that's just come out, Elixir, available on Amazon.com, is about has a medical kind of an urgency, and kind of folds in beautifully with what's going on with our race to find medical miracles. Tell me about it, please.
Yeah, you know, as a physician, I have a longstanding history with the pharmaceutical companies and, you know, have realized over the years that they are money-making, for-profit organizations, and that's what they are. And so in Elixir, what I wanted to do was have a mainstream thriller with a gay protagonist who's a pediatric cancer researcher who essentially has come up with a cure for cancer. It's based on very real medical science, a not far-fetched genetic manipulation that I would not be at all surprised if someone hasn't already done what he does in this book. And it asks the question, what would the drug companies do if they had a cure for cancer? Would they actually ever let it out to the public when the current reality is, you know, any individual with cancer is essentially worth $1 million or more with these treatments that will, you know, sort of prolong life, put people through extraordinarily expensive and difficult procedures that at the end of the day don't necessarily have great chances of being effective.
Right, right. And then you add into that, of course, you know, personal, you know, personalities and greed and lust and, you know, all sorts of other things. The book's great, by the way. So Elixir, it's out already and available on Amazon.com as well as Kindle. So how did you get started writing? And I mentioned a little bit earlier in your introduction, you write both as Charles Atkins, M.D., in your novels. You also write as your nom de plume, Caleb James, mostly urban fantasies, one of my favorite books that I interviewed you 7 years ago. I went and looked it up before time flies, was The Halfling. Could you talk a little bit about why you have these two parallel writing styles?
Yeah, I write as three authors. So I write as Charles Atkins, MD, mostly for clinical books and textbooks, and then Charles Atkins for the more mainstream thrillers and mysteries, and then urban fantasy, where I leave the realm of sort of accepted reality. I came up with Caleb James initially, because I thought these were all going to be young adult, new adult novels. And increasingly, I think the thing that unites the Caleb James book is really that they're urban fantasy. They all have gay protagonists. And the Halfling trilogy, which I adore, was my opportunity to do a real hero trilogy using Irish myth and mythology and you know, the 16-year-old kid, Alex, who, you know, is living a very tough life in New York. He has a mother who has schizophrenia. He's got an 11-year-old sister. And he's just trying to hold it together and, you know, not mm-hmm. have protective services, yank him and his sister, you know, into foster care, which has happened once, which was catastrophic. His sister was molested. What you find out as the novel progresses, he actually killed the man who abused his sister. And so it's a very complex but fun to read book, even though it gets into some mm-hmm. very heavy stuff. So that's, you know, right. that's why you come up with the nom de plume is, you know, mm-hmm. someone who reads Elixir who wants a more reality-based medical
right.
thriller
right.
like something from Michael Crichton or, you know,
right.
even James Patterson.
Correct.
They'll recognize it. But
right.
they may or may
right.
not want Halfling. Or the book I'm working
right.
on currently, which is going to be my fifth Caleb James book, and I'm using a theme I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to write a vampire novel, so I've
uh-huh.
got a contemporary series that's starting where I'm setting it in Boston. I'm setting it in a very, you know, contemporary, identifiable setting, and I'm, you know,
uh-huh.
setting it right now in the middle of COVID, and
right.
My protagonist is a vampire who works as a paramedic.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, I get feedback from my, I've done about 200 of these interviews, and I get a lot of feedback, and I've interviewed a lot of young adult novelists, some young you know, actual novelists who are young. And the theme of vampires or shapeshifters, both of those, are really very incredibly popular. In fact, I spoke with a publisher. I don't know if he's still working, Don Weese, with Magnus
oh, yeah.
Publishing. And he said that's where they make the most money. If it's a shapeshifter or a vampire, young adult, those are the ka-chings. That's what the young people are reading, which is great. I reading anything is great, but I mean, I'm just saying, isn't it interesting how things have shifted? I call that, it's the fallout from Harry Potter. They were raised on Harry Potter and now they want more.
Okay, you want my Don Weiss story?
Sure, go ahead. Don's a friend of mine.
All right, So when I first got into publishing, I started with a 2-book deal with St. Martin's Press. So I, you know,
right.
I started at pretty much the top of the food chain for publishing.
You did. St. Martin's
and,
is great.
Yeah, and I came out with a book called The Portrait. And my then editor, who was something of a lion in the murder mystery field, a woman named Ruth Cavan, you know, was looking for the second book. So Ruth was an older woman at the time. She was in her 80s. And so I wrote a murder mystery, a cozy. I channeled my inner Agatha Christie.
Uh-huh.
And I came up with these two older women protagonists, and I wrote this book, you know, about women living in a retirement community, and all the antique dealers are sort of preying on these old folks as they downsize and
uh-huh.
die, and someone is
uh-huh.
killing these antique dealers, kind of like who's killing the great chefs of Europe.
Correct.
So I had my agent show it to Ruth, and she absolutely hated it. Hated it. It's not what she wanted. So that book went into a drawer, and I'll fast forward. But I really liked that book, and occasionally I take it out and brush it off and try to, you know, find somebody who would publish it, and I didn't. And so one day I'm chatting with my agent, who started a company called Writer's House in New York, a huge agency. And he had met with Don Weiss when Don was at still at Allison.
Okay.
And Don said he was looking for a murder mystery series with gay protagonists and had asked Al if he had an author who might have something. So Al asked me if I had something. And I really didn't. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. I have this book with these two older women protagonists. Maybe I don't have them be quite so old. I have them fall in love with each other. And so I completely revoiced the book and,
mm-hmm.
you know, did it as my first foray into a lesbian mystery novel.
Wow.
And sent it, you know, to my agent. And Allison at that point had gone belly up. But unbeknownst to me, my agent did what a good agent does. He sent it out to another publisher who came back and said, yes, absolutely, but only if it's a series. So that's how the series has started with Vultures at Twilight. And there's been three of them, the last of which was a Lambda finalist for Best Lesbian Mystery, a book called Done to Death, where I kill a Martha Stewart-like person.
Oh, no, you can't do that.
That's how those books came to be. But it was like such a, you know, it's everything to do with the weirdness of writing fiction, that everything can be changed. And, you know, I absolutely adore those, you know, those two characters and those what are essentially are Agatha Christie style cozies, but with lesbian protagonists.
Yeah, that's great. But yeah, we are in a very fluid state, in not just in gay publishing, but in all publishing, because of the, I'm going to use a word, democratization of publishing, where, you know, I could get a book out in 20 minutes and have it, you know, on Amazon with a cover and a blurb and pictures and everything. And yet, you know, it would not be edited and it would not be promoted. And then you have, I know, I understand. I've read them all, please. I get them every week. And then trust, it's just amazing. But you know, I'm very, I used to think they were like, I was getting a little annoyed by the sheer numbers of them. And now I'm kind of like, oh, you know what? I'm glad everyone's kind of like, you know, channeling creative something other than, you know, being nasty online or, you know, shooting people or whatever. I'm glad people have an outlet and they're doing some really good stuff, except it's really hard to filter through it. And then, you know, gay publishing, of course, was a niche within a niche within a niche. And of course it got hit with, you know, online and self-publishing. And then in within the self-publishing field, there's even a lot of scams and all sorts of other things. So I think it's all going to level out. I think it's going to take another 7 or 8, 10 years, but we will see a leveling out with all of it. But yeah, everything's fluid and you never know where your book's going to pop up. Never know. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to give you my 2 second short story. I wrote a chapter in Chicken Soup for the Soul, the second edition, almost 20 years ago.
Yep.
I don't know if you know the story of Chicken Soup for the Soul. They had an incredible amount of trouble getting that published, even though once they got it published, it sold 65 million copies. The second one sold 137 million copies in 12 languages. I mean, it was really ridiculous. Yet they. I know it's crazy, but in contact with the editors and publishers, you know, most of the time, and they were shocked at how much trouble they had. And this was before, you know, the self-publishing stuff. So things just don't make any sense. But we'll get off that now. Okay, so let me go and give you a little plug here. The Halfling series, the original trilogy, of course, the first one's The Halfling, the second one is Exile, the third one is Hound, and what's the fourth one? I don't have it in front of me.
The fourth one is a standalone called Dark Blood, which is a very dark, gothic thriller that uses gypsy motifs, and it's the story of a lot of it's set in New Orleans, and you know, it's a story of this young man who's from a lineage where, you know, once a generation, you know, a child is born with the ability to lay on hands. And it typically goes south for that person, that there's kind of this equal and opposite dark force, you know, that is constantly trying to come after this individual. So it's a book I absolutely loved writing because I was able to really dip into a lot of, you know, fairy tale and myth and, you know, put down these layers of, you know, sort of quirky
right.
mysticism and New Orleans, weirdness.
Yeah, right. Well, New Orleans is weirdness. You're exactly right. So, does that third one, the fourth one? I'm sorry. Is that Alex again, or did you give it as a
character? No, that's a complete standalone. So that's
okay.
Dark
that's
Blood is not part of the Halfling trilogy.
Okay, okay. That's why I didn't have it as obviously. Okay, but it's an urban, one of the urban fantasy mysteries. Got it. Okay,
yeah.
So let's get back to the elixir. But you know what? Even your medical mysteries and your cozies, all of them have this fight of good and evil. You know, and whether it's a human force or corporate force, in the fantasy, it's a ethereal, mystical force. But they're all this fight in good and evil, and the personalities, of course, come out with, you know, the fallible hero and all these other stuff. There is a theme in all of your books, and they all seem to at least end. You feel better ending. You don't have any bad endings, which I like. And I don't like to have bad endings, but I don't. I mean, I'm getting old, too old for these cliffhangers. So in the elixir, there's so much in the elixir that is parallel to the companies right now, especially with HIV. You know, we have 1.5 million people in the United States on $40,000-$50,000 a year medical pharmaceuticals plus another $30,000-$50,000 in medical testing to take the $30,000-$40,000 worth of medical. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, in the long term, for long-term survivors, $100 million to $2 million for every HIV patient, just like the cancer patients, which $1 million is nothing because 24 years ago, my bill was $1 million and $750,000. So yeah, I think we're into $2 and $3 million for a cancer patient now, especially if there's a stem cell or an experiment. They charge you even if it's an experimental drug. Did you know that?
Yeah,
it's crazy.
So the layers of corruption and evil are almost unfathomable for people who haven't, you know, worked in the belly of, you know, the medical profession.
Sure.
And my indoctrination came in medical school, where you're this dog-tired third- and fourth-year medical student. So I'm at Grady Memorial Hospital in downtown Atlanta. You know, you're doing these 24-hour, 36-hour shifts. And once a month, they would have this thing called drug fair that was held on the top floor of Grady Memorial. And you'd go up in your grungy lab coat, and suddenly there were these beautiful men and women and really expensive suits who, you know, they'd open the doors to the auditorium and they'd hand you these essentially Halloween goodie bags. And you'd be ushered into this auditorium filled with people who were going to be nice to you and give you stuff and chat with you. And the stuff was expensive stuff. And that was a drug fair. It was once a month. And, you know, you'd then go back like a kid with your Thanksgiving goodie bag and you'd spill it on the floor of your, you know, student housing. And, you know, there'd be a $100, $200 textbook and that stethoscope you really couldn't afford, but somebody had just given it to you. And it began to dawn on me that, you know, why do people give gifts? Well, because they love you. Maybe they want to sleep with you. But there's something going on there. And when I became a medical director, I remember going into my office one day and on my desk was a black velvet jewelry box. Now you like a black velvet jewelry box in general. Those are good things.
Right.
And I opened it up and it was a Mont Blanc pen with my name in gold from the makers of Xanax.
Right.
And I remember looking at it going, I'd never owned a Mont Blanc pen. It was very nice. And realizing that there was something just wrong about this. So I had my secretary, you know, call the drug rep and return it. And he was very upset because what are you going to do, you know, with a $100, $200 pen with someone's name in gold on it?
Sure.
And, you know, then began to go into the research more and more of what is going on between, you know, physicians and the drug companies, and how this ultimately led to things like the opioid overdose epidemic, where,
sure,
as you started to look at what really happened there, it had,
yeah,
everything,
exactly,
to do with overprescribing of medications,
right,
based on no research.
Right.
And the drug companies deliberately identifying physicians who are more likely to prescribe these things and,
right,
you know, market the hell out of them. And now,
exactly,
they have the drugs to treat the problem they created.
Problem.
So it's,
exactly. Yeah. Perfect.
It's
no,
the
not
perfect,
perfect.
The perfect crime. You know, make the problem,
yeah,
then come up with a solution and, you know, make your money,
right,
on both sides of it.
Right. Kind of like the for-profit prisons. You know, after,
yeah,
after you know, making the stuff, but you just pull back the curtain a little bit for our listeners on what goes on. But there's a second chapter to that with the drug companies, and that is once you are in private practice, as I was and my husband was. My husband's a retired psychiatrist. I'm a retired dentist. The drug reps show up to your office. And, you know, the way to a person's heart is through their stomach, with elaborate catered lunches for you and your entire staff. Now, I had a staff of 7. My husband didn't have a big staff like that. But you know, once every 2 or 3 months, Eli Lilly would show up at my office with, you know, a several hundred dollars lunch for 7, or maybe even more than that, complete, you know, salads. Beautiful desserts, entrees, or things like that. And all of this was for a 3-minute pitch on how their pain pill that was addictive wasn't addictive. We're talking about the Darvon world. I'm 70 years
oh,
old.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking about the same exact thing that went on with the opioids, and people were addicted to Darvon. If you had a surgical patient or a patient with some long-term dental problems, and you gave them a prescription for Darvon, and it was a large one, you started getting those phone calls at 7 o'clock on Sunday nights or Friday nights, asking you for a refill, and you were in a hurry, so you refilled it, and then you just it almost just kind of snuck up on you that the patients were addicted. And as I said, this is a problem you've seen in the opioid, and you've written about it in your medical information books, how the people that became addicted didn't fit the profile of the buggy-eyed person on the corner or the junkie looking for their next fix. They were housewives driving carpool. They were husbands in bowling leagues. And these were people who were just so innocent, who had a medical problem, were trying to get out of pain. They trusted their doctor. Their doctor, unfortunately, trusted the drug companies. And I was as guilty as many people in overprescribing a product that turned out to be quite dangerous. For a while, and until they took it off the market. But of course, the opioid crisis is a lot worse than the others. But yeah, I mean, but it is an issue. And
it's mass murder at this point, because we've got 60 to 70,000 overdose deaths a year, and all of that goes back to exactly what you talked about. To those Darvon reps, those OxyContin reps. And,
right,
you know, when I was writing the book on opioids, which came out in 2018, and I was looking at, well, you know, where did, you know, how could this have happened? And trying to see, you know, where was the medical research to support,
right,
all of these prescriptions? And it came down to a single letter to the New England Journal of Medicine from two physicians,
really,
who had done an in-hospital, you know, study looking at, you know, hospitalized patients who were put on, you know, what they called narcotics at the time. to see how many of them became addicted while they were in the hospital. And the results of this hospital-based, you know, kind of not not placebo-controlled, not rigorous study, you know, found that, gee, people really don't seem to get addicted after having a few narcotics in the hospital. And single letter by these two physicians became the basis of all of the pharmaceutical marketing. You know, as mentioned, you know, as described in New England Journal of Medicine, not likely to cause addiction. And
not
that was
likely.
It. Yeah, that was it. That was the research.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea because I thought it was a much, you know, I thought that, you know, with the drug companies funding a lot of research, that they would have somehow manipulated a real double-blind study. But obviously, oh, my God, that's even worse.
Letter, not even an article, a letter to the New England Journal.
Oh, my God.
And those two
poor
physicians who've since, you know, really been identified as kind of part of the ground zero, you know, they're like, what happened? How did this?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it was an innocent letter. I mean, and what they were reporting on was, at the time, at that snapshot, the truth. But it was just a snapshot. It was not a study. Right.
Yeah.
If what you're explaining is correct, it was a snapshot. Yeah. So let me go over your books again. You can order Opioid Use Disorders, A Holistic Guide to Assessment, Treatment, and Recovery by Charles Atkins, M.D. I have not read it, but I hope it looks like it reads pretty easily. Mysteries. Okay. You can go to charlesatkins.com for a listing of all of his books, also some of his latest stuff. I'm going to just go over a couple of the mysteries. The cozies that he talked about, that was the Lil and Ada. Are those the two names? Am I getting that right?
Lil and Ada.
Lil and Ada, Best Place to Die, Vultures of Twilight, Done to Death. I've read Done to Death. We talked about that a few years ago. But it's a really interesting – you've got a really interesting bookshelf of stuff. You said – I think we spoke earlier. So how did you get started with your writing? What was your first foray into writing?
My first foray – boy – really had to do with, you know, in medical school, I did essay competitions, you know, had some success with that. I've always written. And then when I was a resident at Yale doing my psychiatric residency, I was doing a research project that I ended up just really hating. And had written my supervisor at like 3 o'clock in the morning saying, you know, I'm sorry I've wasted your time. I don't like this research project, which was on the subjective nature, the person, you know, what the person experiences who has a serious mental illness. And he responded and he said, you know, okay, so you don't like the research project. What is it that interested you about, you know, this project to begin with? And I said, you know, well, it's people and their stories. And he was a fabulous supervisor, and he came back and he said, well, that's what you should be writing. And so I kind of took that as permission, and I began to do a series of short stories about people with mental illness, almost like a Whitman sampler. And I would do play with point of view. I would be the person. I would be the person's mother, psychiatrist, brother, friend, lover. And I started sending them out and, you know, started getting them published in different places. And I had a character of a young boy with manic depression who I sat down one day and said, well, what happens if he were my age? And I was in my 30s at that point. You know, where would he be? What would he be doing? And it turned into my first murder mystery, a book called The Portrait. And that's kind of in my path as a writer. Whatever I'm working on as a psychiatrist is what will go into my novels, which now that I'm working on a vampire novel, I have to think if that's still true.
Right.
And it's
we are at the very end here.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got like 10 seconds left to go. I mean, it was And I just want to thank you. You got you. This is so much fun. We had fun 7 years ago. We had fun today. Thank you. And goodbye from Fort Lauderdale.
Goodbye, Nate. And we'll talk again.
Thank you.